enjoying a coffee, and then went down to Punta Arenas, where I was stuck for almost 10 days because the world didn't clear, and I got very, very sick. This happens sometimes. I remembered wanting to come back, and thank you for the opportunity to do so. What we're going to talk about today is two talks. The first one is going to be about the long tail. The second one is a preview of my next book, Free. The two are related in a way that I will explain. The way they're related is that they're both the economics of the world around us. This is not a world that economists normally focus on for reasons that are not entirely clear to me. This is the world of culture, is the world of our society, is the world of the internet, is the world that is pretty much defining the 21st century, and for some reason, economists don't study it. So I do, and we'll talk about what the economic perspective is of the century that we're entering. And it starts. I'll try to switch to this. This here. I'm walking from the projector, so maybe I'll stay here. Let's start with a reminder of just how different the 20th century was from the years before it. The 20th century was defined largely by the invention of broadcast. And when you think about broadcast, this is radio in the 1920s and 30s, and then television in the 1950s, you realize that it changed culture in a way that was really driven by economics. Before broadcast, if you wanted to communicate, if you wanted to perform, if you wanted to spread culture, you could only do it person by person and town by town. So music was performance rather than recording. Communications was largely person to person, voice to voice. But at the end of the 1800s and the beginning of the 1900s, we began some new technologies that had the ability to distribute culture faster than people could. First, it was recording technologies, which made the record. Then it was photographic technologies. Then high-speed printing, which allowed you to have the national newspaper. And each one of them allowed culture to be turned into a product that could be distributed to many people simultaneously. But nothing came close to broadcast. What radio did was allow you to take one piece of culture and distribute it at no cost to millions of people. From an economic perspective, what radio does is it lowers the marginal cost of distributing culture to zero. So to reach 2 million people costs no more than 1 million people, and to reach 10 million people costs no more than that. And that is incredibly powerful. For the first time in history, we had an economic model that allowed us to reach everybody simultaneously. But there was a cost. The cost was we could only do it with a very limited number of channels, a limited number of stations, a limited amount of culture. You could reach an entire country for the price of a single person, but you could only do so with maybe 6 radio stations, 4 television channels, etc. And so we had to invent a new form of culture called mass media. We had to invent a kind of culture that could satisfy everybody all the time. And this was, we invented the blockbuster. The blockbuster is the bestseller, the hit. This is what's defined the 20th century. We had to invent a kind of culture that everybody liked. Now, before the 20th century, the only kind of mass culture you really had was the church, or the Bible, or things, or politics. It was a very limited number of mass culture. The rest of culture was individual. You had your family culture, you had your town culture. You know, your friends had a different culture than friends on the other side of the country. But mass media snapped national culture into lockstep. It's suddenly we were watching the same things at the same time. We were listening to the same things at the same time. Suddenly, you know, you could have a concept of national culture and then global culture. And the effect, and the rise of Hollywood and sort of, you know, the Western culture of the rest of the world was driven by mass media. That is the 20th century, and we assumed, that's the century we grew up in, and we assumed that that's what we wanted. We assumed that mass culture was the sort of, you know, the evolutionary ideal. This was basically where we had been leading all these many years, was to prime time, top 40, the national conversation. What's happening now, however, is that something's changing, and I will mark the day when mass culture came to an end. This is March 21st, 2000. It's the first day of spring of a new century. It was 7 days after the stock market crash, the dot-com bubble, and it was the release of this album here. This is a record album by an American boy band called NSYNC. This is their second album called No Strings Attached. This is the pinnacle of 20th century culture. This is the best-selling album of all time. Anywhere in the world. This is the best-selling album in history. This album sold 2.41 million copies in the first week. Went on to sell 10 million copies in its first year. It is the product of a blockbuster machinery that was hitting on all cylinders. This is what the 20th century was building towards. Now you may look at this and say, you know, okay, well we have a hit album every year, we have many hit albums every year. Every year, you know, it set records, but this is the last hit album, this is the last blockbuster. This is what happened to music. After that, this is the number of hit albums after the release of No Strings Attached. And basically, it fell and fell and fell some more. And it will never come back. We will never have another blockbuster like that one silly album by a boy band in 2000. And the reason we're never going to have another album like that is because it turns out that's not what we want. So that's what some of us want, but it's not what all of us want. And what stopped right around then was not our musical taste. It was not, the power of bands to communicate with audiences. What changed was distribution. Around 2000 is when digital distribution via the internet of music started to take off. And suddenly we didn't have to get our music from the radio, and we didn't have to get our music from a record store, and we didn't have to get our music in an album on a CD on a lump of plastic that costs $15. Suddenly we could have what we wanted, when we wanted, at whatever price we wanted, and that price was increasingly zero. So this effect was basically the fragmentation of the music industry. I'll go back. We think of the music industry as being in collapse, but in fact, it's not in collapse. The music industry is doing fine, except for one part of the music industry, and that one part is the sale of CDs. Every other part of the music industry is doing fine. Digital singles going up, licensing going up, touring going up, merchandise going up. There's more music being created than ever before. There's more music being listened to than ever before. If you include the iPod in the music industry has never been bigger than it is today. What's broken is the blockbuster side of the music industry. This is not just music. It's also true for television. Here's the slide that shows you what's happened as television channels, as we get more television channels with cable television and then digital cable and satellite, etc., the share of the number one show in America, at least, and this is true for most markets, continues to decline. Same effect. More choice means less concentrated choice around a small number of products. This, too, is also the end of the prime time. It's the end of the sort of singular moment when everybody is watching the same thing at the same time. And it's not because There's nothing wrong with television. We still like television. The problem is that we like different television. And the television we like, we want to watch when we want to watch it on our own schedule. We're not prepared to sit down and, as a synchronized culture, watch the same thing at the same time. Apologies for the American example. This is just an example of how much it has changed. In the 1950s, in America, 70% of American homes were watching the same show at the same time, a show called I Love Lucy. This is the era of the electronic hearth. This is the era when families would schedule their lives around a broadcast timetable, that you would actually come home to watch a show. And that after that show, you would watch the news. And everybody in the country, 70% of American homes, would watch the same news at the same time. That moment never existed before and would never exist again. That was an anomaly. That was not the natural state of things. That was an abnormal state of things created by this powerful technology called broadcast. And today, the number one shows continue to have lower and lower share. Not because the television is worse, not because we don't like television, but because we have more choice. So once again, more choice means more fragmentation. More choice means that we're less and less acting like one collective body, and more acting like individuals. We're seeing the same thing happen in newspapers, as newspapers decline. There's nothing wrong with news. What's wrong is that there's no one newspaper can suit everybody. The competition is the internet, not a departure from news itself. We see the same thing in movies. The peak of Hollywood's power was after World War II. And the biggest competition for Hollywood, the per capita attendance of theaters. The competition for theaters was not bad movies or being out in the sun. The competition was television. Television offered more choice. And after television came VCRs, and then DVDs, and then home theaters, and soon the internet. The problem is that we're not all the same, and you cannot get people to move in a herd anymore. So from an economics perspective, this is basically a shift from one kind of curve to another kind of curve. Many of you I know are economists or business students, and you're familiar with this curve. This is called a Gaussian distribution. And this is the way we see markets. We assume that markets look like this. Like you have, some people on one fringe, some people on the other, but you look for the people in the middle. You try to create products that are aimed for the average consumer. And, once you get the average consumer, then you try to get products for, a few standard deviations beyond the average consumer. The problem is that there is no average consumer anymore. We're all different, and it's impossible to lump us into groups that make sense, because those groups keep shrinking as we become more refined in our taste and define ourselves by our differences rather than our commonalities. So this is another curve. This is the curve of the 20th century. This curve is called a Pareto distribution. It's named after Vilfredo Pareto, an Italian economist. He observes in the Italian economy in the 1800s that 80% of the land was held by 20% of the population. And as he looked around Europe at the time, he found this was true everywhere he looked, that 80% of the wealth was held by 20% of the population. And what he did observe was a very unequal distribution. And this observation that the few had the most power, that the most wealth was in the hands of the fewest people, this led to a concern that maybe there was something wrong with the political systems of Europe at the time. Maybe this was an example of feudalism, or class structures, or unequal access to education. And so socialism and communism and many of the kind of political experiments of the mid-20th century were all designed to try to flatten this curve, to try to redistribute wealth so it was 50% of the population had 50% of the wealth. So this failed, and failed for reasons that had nothing to do with whether this was good, well, it had something to do with it, whether it was a good political system, but it had more to do with the fact that this curve, the Pareto distribution, is the curve of our species. This is the natural distribution of the human race. And what it, and what this curve tells you is that what you have is a very unequal distribution. Some things are very popular, and things that are very popular tend to get more popular. It's something mimetic propagation. And what it means is that we like doing things that other people do. We understand this. The rich get richer for the same reason. We rich people have access to other rich people. Rich people have access to wealth. Popular things get more popular because people spread word of this. That's where a gregarious species, we're networked together. But there's the other aspect of the Pareto distribution's, the tail. And the tail says that although the head is full of things that are very popular and it falls off very quickly, the tail is very long. There's a lot of things in the tail, and collectively, the things in the tail add up to as big a market as the head. So let me give you some data from this. This is the music industry online. Now, when you think of that, I use music as an example because music is something that we all listen to. It reflects the variety of culture, and it's been very badly treated by the 20th century. The way we distribute music in the 20th century is via physical objects, records, and CDs, on a store. And the problem with doing it that way is that it's very expensive to get music to consumers. It's expensive to make the CDs, because they're physical objects. It's expensive to distribute the CDs, and it's expensive to store the CDs on a shelf, because shelf space is limited. And so as a result, there's only room in the physical world for hits. Only hits can pay the rent on expensive shelf space. So the red line here represents the inventory, and this is actually 2005 data in the physical store. It's the inventory of the largest record store in the world, which is a retailer called Walmart. And Walmart has about 3,000 CDs, which is about 50,000 tracks of music, 50,000 songs. Now, in 1990, you would go to a Walmart and you would assume that's pretty much all the music there was. But you would be wrong. There was actually a lot more music. There was, in fact, hundreds of thousands of tracks being made every year, but you just couldn't buy them. You couldn't buy them because they didn't sell well enough to pass the economic test of that particular retailer. Once we moved to digital distribution online, we no longer had the constraints of shelf space. The marginal cost of getting a track to a consumer is close to zero. And when the cost of getting a track to a consumer is close to zero, then the amount of it that you can distribute becomes infinite. You have, in a sense, infinite shelf space. And when you have infinite shelf space, suddenly you can see all the music that's there, not just the hits. And so what we have is that this is the sales of online music. And what you see is that the hits that are sold in Walmart are also the most popular songs online. But where the red line stops is where the online market keeps going. And what you have is 3 million tracks. This is a couple of years ago. Today you have 5 million tracks. Online and peer-to-peer networks, you have maybe 10 million tracks. So you have orders of magnitude more music online than you do in physical stores. So what does this mean for this shape of the market? So these bars here represent the top bars represent the difference in inventory, the difference in variety and choice, online versus offline. Online is yellow, offline is red. So you can see everywhere online where you have infinite shelf space, you have many, many times more choice. And the consequence is that people start to take that choice. As you can see, the pies represent the fraction of first music, then DVDs, and then books that are sold online and offline. The red part is the stuff that is offline, and sold in stores. And the yellow part is the stuff that is only available online. And what you find is that 40% of the music market today is music that is not available in stores. 21% of the DVD market, of the film market online, are DVDs that are not available in stores. 25% of the book market online are books that are not available in stores. Each one of these markets are for a variety that was not available in the 20th century. They're not available because they didn't pass the test of that distribution system. But in the current distribution system, there is no economic test. Everything that is made will get out there. Everything that is out there, you can find. You can buy whatever you want, whenever you want it, at almost any price you want, especially for these digital goods. I've only mentioned the things that are sold, but remember that all these things are also available for free if you want to go to the peer-to-peer services, if you want to pirate them, and many people do. We'll talk about that in the next hour. So the important message here is that there is a new market, and this new market is of goods, content, culture that was invisible in the 20th century. It was there, but hidden. And what this reflects is what we really want, but we just didn't know it before. When people are given a choice between 10 things, they will choose one of those 10 things. But if you give them a choice of 10,000 things, they may not choose the same 10 that they first chose. Once we're given more choice, we begin to learn ourselves. We begin to learn what we want and who we are. We begin to understand our choices better. We become more educated about variety. We become more discriminating in our taste. That's what's happening in the 21st century. That's what's happening in the generation that's growing up online. And that is the long tail. The long tail is the recognition that one size doesn't fit all. The recognition that we are not all alike. The recognition that we're often happiest with the things that are unique to our taste and not necessarily shared. The long tail is about the rise of the specific rather than the general. And that is defining the generation that's growing up online today. So let's turn this into some rules. The first rule is that as we move online into a world of near zero marginal cost, we have lowered the cost of distribution. And when you lower the cost of distribution, you can offer more stuff. If you offer more stuff, you can now satisfy what economists call minority taste. There has been no room for minority taste for the last 100 years. There's only room for majority taste. Majority taste is half the game. The other half, minority taste, was a neglected market. This is the dark matter of our culture. This is the ice underneath the ice, the iceberg under the water. This is where all the growth is coming in these industries. Minority taste was considered a bad thing. It was considered what you should ignore because you couldn't make money from it. And now you see some of the biggest companies in the world, including Google, building their growth and their success around satisfying minority taste. Minority taste is not a bad thing. Minority taste is absolutely, absolutely the core of who we are. We are individuals. And by as individuals, we are all of us in some way or another differ from those around us. We may all watch the same football games, we may follow the same politics, but in some part of your life, everybody in this room has some interest that is not shared by anybody else. Whether it's your cultural interest, whether it's your family, whether it's your community, whether it's your business interest, whether it's your hobby, some part of your life is minority taste. And now we have room for that. Finally, when you add up all that minority taste, you get a very big market. Now, the trick is, how do you do that? How do you efficiently add up all that minority taste? And, we have a lot of examples online. We have not yet figured out how to do that very easily in the physical world, but I'll talk about that more in a minute. But the point is, there's a lot of room at the bottom of the market. A lot of room in the categories that were neglected because they didn't pass the test of limited shelf space. So That's digital content. Those are digital goods. It's easy to understand those. But, you know, what about physical goods? Well, eBay, for example, is the long tail of physical goods. Everything that was ever made is out there somewhere, and eBay is one way you can find it. So we understand that. This one, however, is more of a surprise. When I wrote the book in 1997, originally, there's a new version out now, but after the book came out, I read that America's largest beer maker, Anheuser-Busch, was creating a new division called long-tail libations. I did not expect this. This was a surprise. So I said, I'm wondering, what is the long tail of beer? So I called up Anheuser-Busch, and in exchange for allowing them to keep the name, I asked them to explain. And they sent me this slide. This is the inventory of beer. This is the amount of beer they made. This is the different kinds of beer they made in 1997. This is one-size-fits-all beer. You're familiar with some of these beers, possibly. I assure you, this is not good beer. This is what happens when you try to satisfy all tastes simultaneously. You satisfy no tastes. This is the lowest common denominator. This is what happens when you have limited shelf space. But over the years, over the decade after 1997, something changed, even in traditional retail, even in the supermarket. What happened is we began to bring technology even to the physical world. Our inventory management software became more sophisticated. We had just-in-time delivery of products. We were able to do market research and identify where demand for individual beers might be so that we could essentially double the number of products on the shelf of a supermarket. And that's actually what happened. Over the years, 1997 to 2007, we doubled the number of products on an average store shelf. And you see this everywhere around the world. That, you know, you go from one kind, you know, maybe five kinds of jam to 25 kinds of jam as you introduce things like light and regular and maybe organic and maybe exotic fruits and things like this. Supermarkets didn't have to buy 1,000 of anything. They could buy 10 of something and efficiently store it. And it was little things like the barcode and point of sale terminals, software connections between point of sale terminals and suppliers and all that. So what does this mean for beer? Well, this is 1997 and this is 2007. They basically tripled the number of products they make. And then they released this product here. This is the first product from this new division, Long Tail Libations. This is a beer called Redbridge. This beer is the world's first non-allergenic beer. This beer is gluten-free for people who have gluten allergies. The way you make gluten-free beer is you make it with sorghum rather than wheat or barley. So, you know, it's really interesting that it took till 2007 to release the world's first gluten-free beer. As you know, we've had gluten allergies as long as we've been a species. The Egyptians were the first people to make beer with sorghum rather than wheat or barley. But it wasn't until we were able to bring the technologies to the supermarket so that you could have 25 kinds of beer rather than just five that we finally had room for this particular kind of minority taste. So the point is that this is not just about the internet. That even in the physical world, there's a lot of minority taste that is being neglected. And only now are we being able to target it efficiently by using technology to offer, to essentially increase the amount of shelf space. So that is beer. If you think about it, coffee is another great example of this. 20 years ago, coffee was something you buy in a can. Today we have Starbucks and you have an infinite amount of variety, an infinitely refined taste about coffee, where the beans come from, how they're prepared, what combination you put them together. Chile has always been a very sophisticated country in coffee, but the United States was not. And now the United States is becoming more sophisticated, but Chile is also becoming more sophisticated. And that we now understand that there's not just beans from different environments, but there's also how the beings were prepared, organic, non-organic, fair trade, non-fair trade. We now are globally sourcing the beans from more and more exotic locations. Obviously, the in food, the rise of organic and artisanal food is an example of the long tail. Not everybody wants. Everybody's taste is different, and now we are able to satisfy that. You know, not so long ago, water was something that you drank from the, you got from the tap. Now there is an infinite variety of different kinds of waters, not just where they come from, but what's in the water, what's not in the water. You know, vitamin water, you know, artisanal sources as well. Obviously, Chile, as being a wine exporter, understands that wine has always been a long-tail business, where the smallest sellers command the highest prices, and that tastes are very refined. But now we're seeing the same effects in more and more food commodities, and chocolate is the next one. You're going to see chocolate follow the same path as coffee, where people become increasingly refined and discriminating about where the beans come from, how they're prepared, organic versus non-organic, fair trade versus non-fair trade. You know, chocolate is another commodity that is being long-tailed. Another interesting example is travel. Again, if you think about the rules of the long tail, if you can lower the cost of distribution, you can offer more stuff. Well, the same thing applies to travel. If you can lower the cost of travel, you can offer more destinations. The rise of the low-cost carriers in Europe in particular has radically increased the number of destinations that you can now easily fly to. The way the carriers were able to lower the cost of the travel was not by making airplanes cheaper or by lowering the price of fuel. They lower the cost of travel by redefining the business. When you have a company like Ryanair, Ryanair is not in the selling seats business. Ryanair is in, broadly, the moving people around business, or more broadly, moving things around. So the reason Ryanair can charge 5 euros for a seat, or 0 euros for a seat, is that they have all these other ways of making money. They sell rental cars and hotel reservations. They sell, of course, food on the plane. They have advertising, both on their website and on the plane. They actually charge you extra for your luggage if you go on the plane, because what they're actually selling is the cargo space to companies who are shipping packages. And so when you put your luggage in the hold, you're displacing a paying customer, which is the cargo. They get by going to non-traditional locations, they get subsidies from those locations because they're bringing business to cities that don't get enough business. And so by lowering the landing fees and by getting direct payments from these locations, they can lower the cost to the consumer even more. And they are talking about taking the flight down to zero, to making it absolutely free, by offering gambling on the flight. So in the same way that you know, a casino will offer you a free drink because they're selling you a card game, so perhaps an airline can offer you a free seat because they're selling a gambling opportunity as well. It's no new economic model. They just creatively thought about what business they're in. And so the effect of being able to reach more and more locations at lower cost is that you're actually seeing a shift in traffic. These are statistics from the UK. Over just a four-year period, from 2001 to 2005. But what happened is that people are going to the Parises and the Berlins less, and they're going to the Portos and in smaller towns outside of the big cities more. The reason they're willing to do this is not just because it's cheap. There are two costs when you're traveling. One is the cost of the travel, and the other is the risk, the cost of the risk you take of going to the wrong place. As it becomes easier and easier to understand, to learn about a location remotely, to learn about a location virtually, to do your research as a tourist online, you don't have to settle for the one size fits all. You don't have to settle for Paris when you can research Lyon online and make, and understand that this is really right for you, maybe talking to other tourists. The fact is that Google is the best travel agent you'll ever find. And that's because Google is able to tap the collective knowledge of everybody out there, professionals and amateurs. And what this creates is confidence. By being able to move beyond, move off the beaten path, to move beyond the top 10 destinations, by researching and understanding what's right for you, you're able to have more confidence that this trip will be satisfying. And as a result, you're willing to take chances. And that willingness to take chances, the ability of the information to serve as a filter, to bring you choices that you didn't otherwise have, is what's creating a long tail of travel as well. So, shoes. I'm going to walk through more. I'll walk through all these industries that you wouldn't think would be long tail industries, but they are. So there is a, you know, the company Amazon. Well, there is a company like Amazon that sells shoes. This company is called Zappos. Zappos sells more than 100,000 different kinds of shoes. Not 100,000 shoes, but 100,000 different kinds. These are different styles, different sizes, different colors. There is no store in the world that can sell 100,000 kinds of shoes. When you move, now a typical store might sell hundreds of different kinds of shoes, but hundreds of thousands of different kinds of shoes is a totally different proposition. When you go from hundreds to hundreds of thousands, it's not just the same market, but bigger. What happens is that you suddenly learn something about the market. You learn something about shoes. And you discover new categories that you never realized existed before. Zappos has a category of shoes called vegetarian shoes. I'd never heard of vegetarian shoes before, but let me tell you what it is. Vegetarian shoes are shoes that are made without animal products. There's no leather used in their manufacturing. This is the best-selling vegetarian shoe in the world. This is a pink Converse sneaker. It's got a canvas upper and a natural rubber on a sole. It's worth thinking a little bit about who's buying Converse sneakers, pink Converse sneakers. It's probably a woman. The pink is a bit of a tip-off there. It's probably somebody who's socially conscious, someone who is concerned about the environment. It's probably somebody who's very worried about, let's say, labor practices. In a sense, it's if you think about it, it's the kind of person who would not buy Nike. So Nike is plastic and it's made in, you know, and if you're this socially conscious consumer, you probably think that Nike's runs sweatshops and has terrible labor practices in China and other places. So, in matter of fact, you might even be protesting at your school campus, your university campus. You might be protesting the fact that Nike makes the school shirts, and you want to get Nike off your campus. And you might be wearing your Converse sneaker while you're protesting Nike. What you may not know when you're wearing your Converse sneaker while you're protesting Nike is that Converse is a wholly owned subsidiary of Nike. Nike doesn't want you to know this. Nike is a very smart company. By the way, I spent a lot of time with Nike, and I've been to Nike factories, and the sweatshop concerns are vastly overstated. But it doesn't matter what I think. What matters is what the consumer of the pink Converse thinks. And the consumer of the pink Converse doesn't like Nike, but does like Converse. So what Nike has done is they managed to play the head and the tail. They managed to have a one-size-fits-all mass-market product with their sneaker at the bottom and a minority-taste, specific niche product with their Converse brand. And by separating them completely, they get the credibility of the street, you know, retro, you know, very authentic brand Converse, as well as the reach of their main brand, Nike. They get to have it both ways. They get to the head and the tail. And it's interesting to ask, well, if that is what companies must do, play both ends of the curve, how would you do that? I worked for, as you know, I'm the editor of Wired magazine. Wired is a division of a big publishing company called Condé Nast. Condé Nast also publishes Vogue magazine, Vanity Fair, Glamour, The New Yorker. We have a near monopoly on bridal magazines. We are very much a head company. We're a best-selling blockbuster company. Most of our titles are fashion titles, like Vogue. And it's interesting to think about the fashion market. So when you think about fashion, by the way, if it is not obvious to you, I know nothing about fashion. It is amazing to me that I, a former scientist, am working for the company shown last in The Devil Wore Prada. I don't know if you saw that movie, but that's my company. The women in the elevator have pointy shoes. I wear jeans. But that is my company. That's what I do. And so I've had to learn something about fashion. What I've learned about fashion is that it really is a long tail business. When you think about it, boutique and couture is just like wine. It's a case where the smallest sellers command the highest price and have the greatest influence. This is what happens. You have designer fashion starting at a long tail, very small numbers to very discriminating consumers. And yet those discriminating consumers who buy in small numbers but at high prices have a huge amount of influence. And that influence propagates up via mass retailers into the head of the curve. So this is a case where, again, the tail wags the dog, that the long tail is more influential than the head, and that what you have in the tail is the highest prices with the most profit and the most influence, leading to the mass market with the lowest prices and the lowest profit. So we get this. We understand that boutique and couture is part of the long tail, and that we are the vehicle by which the long tail makes it to the mass market. When Vogue puts a fashion designer in the magazine, it is then introducing it to millions and millions of people, which will then propagate out to the mass market. But that's just the traditional long tail of fashion. There's a new long tail of fashion, which is the user generated, the street fashion. Increasingly, fashion is being driven by individuals creating their own fashion, not just designers creating fashion for us. One of the trends in fashion is something called vintage clothing. Vintage clothing is basically a new word for used clothing. But this is used clothing from a very distinct period. You would find maybe dresses from the 1950s. And people who are able to tell the difference between used clothing and vintage clothing, between old clothes that are not of interest and old clothes that are beautiful and can be repurposed in an interesting new way, are called tastemakers. And they are typically just regular people with good taste. The number one retailer of vintage fashion is eBay. eBay does not think of itself as a fashion company. eBay may not even know that it's a fashion company, but eBay is a fashion company. Because eBay enables the long tail of fashion. eBay is a marketplace that has room for everything. It has room for the amateurs as well as the professionals. It has room for mistakes, and it has room for things that will become hits. And as a result, eBay became the de facto marketplace for vintage clothing because it was the only one that was scaled, that was built for the long tail. We at Condé Nast are not, sadly, the marketplace for vintage. Neither is any retailer. Only a marketplace that is built around the long tail could scale down to this level of revenue, scale down to individuals trying to express their own taste at no cost. We do try to scale down to the long tail of fashion. This is our site. So say we have a Vogue magazine, and that is a magazine where an editor picks fashions and spends months presenting them beautifully. And then we also have websites. And one of our websites is called lipstick.com. And lipstick.com is a site where people contribute their own news and links about fashion. We don't control it. We control the magazines. The users control these sites. This is our attempt, this is our converse to Vogue's Nike. This is our attempt to let the users control what we do rather than we controlling what the users see. This is actually not a success. This didn't work. But that's okay. That's okay. This didn't cost us a lot of money, and we do lots and lots of experiments like this. And we, rather than in our 20th century model, where we produce blockbusters and we do everything we can to ensure that they are blockbusters and they do succeed. In our 21st century model, we produce experiments. And our experiments need to be fast and they need to be cheap and most will fail. And that's fine because we will learn something about those failures and we will, next time we will fail differently. I wanted to end by just sort of showing you the nightmare that is my life. The irony is that I work for a blockbuster company, Condé Nast. My book is published by Disney, and yet I celebrate the niche. I celebrate the minority taste. By day, I make blockbusters. By night, I dabble in the narrowest niches you can imagine. Not only is my cultural taste niche, but all of my sort of spin-off companies. Involving things like Lego robotics, I have audiences that number in the high single-digit thousands. It is very interesting to be in the long tail at night and ahead by day. And this chart here gives you a little sense of why it's such a challenge. The traditional ways of measuring impact for media have been in terms of things like circulation. Or viewership, or listenership, or radio, or television, or print. And as we move online, we have a new way of measuring impact. It's not just the mass of number of people you reach, it's also the number of people who react to you by linking to your site. In the Google, you have the traditional measure of impact is attention, and that's just like the 20th century. Viewership is attention, listenership is attention, circulation is attention, and online we have traffic, that's attention. But the more important measure is reputation. And reputation is measured not by surveys, but by incoming links, by the number of people who link to your site. And this is the world of media. This is the world of the internet, measured by incoming links. And it starts the same way the 20th century started, with the New York Times, CNN, the Washington Post, AP, BBC. These are traditional media giants. Newspapers, The Guardian in the UK, the Marine News Service in Japan, etc. There's mine, our sites, it's online, we do slightly better than you would expect. Boston Globe, Times in the UK, these are all newspapers. These are the traditional powerhouses of the 20th century. So far, no surprises. The biggest media organizations, companies of the 20th century, who got their power by commanding the tools of production of the 20th century, which was factories that make paper, also have very high impact, a lot of incoming links in the 21st century. So far, no change. And then we get this. This is this red line here. This is the 10th most powerful site on the internet in 2006. The site with the most incoming links. This is a site called Boing Boing. It is a blog. These are the bloggers. That's Mark and David and John and Corey and Shenny.
They're
bloggers. They are amateurs. They work at home. They have more power. They have more influence. They have more incoming links than Forbes magazine, than Time magazine, than Fox News, than Business Week, than PBS in the United States, than National Public Radio in the United States. And here we have another red line. This is Pete Rojas, who started a blog called Gizmodo. It's a gadgets blog. It was, until he left recently, it was run out of his apartment in Brooklyn. These are, again, bloggers. They sometimes wear pants, sometimes they don't. They never wear shoes. They have more incoming links than MSNBC, MTV, CBS News. This is Frank Warren. He's another blogger. He runs a blog called Post Secret. We're now at about the 25th most powerful media operation in the world. Post Secret is a site where you people write secrets on postcards and send them to him, and he posts them. That's it. He has more incoming links, more power, more influence. He's bigger in the eyes of the Google economy than the Los Angeles Times with its 2,000 reporters and editors, CNN Money, The Telegraph in the UK, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, City Morning Herald, the San Jose Mercury News. This is Marcos of the Daily Kos, a left-wing political blog. He lives down the street from me in Berkeley, California, blogs at home. More incoming links than the Chicago Tribune, Reuters, the International Herald Tribune, the Wall Street Journal, The Economist, the Financial Times, ESPN, Arianna Huffington of the Huffington Post. Another blogger has more links than the Post-Gazette, PR Newswire, Brian Lamb, a blogger who was an intern in my office. Until we didn't have a desk for him, I'm afraid to say. He went off to start a gadget blog called Engadget. Sorry, Pete Rojas runs in Gadget. Brian Lamb runs Gizmodo. And this Gadget blog has more incoming links than 98.7% of the world's newspapers. And this is Glenn Reynolds. He's a law professor at the University of Tennessee. He runs a site called InstaFunded. And he has more power in the Google economy than 99% of all the world's media companies. These bloggers, like Glenn Reynolds, the last one I showed, a law professor who blogs in between classes, a half an hour here and there, has more power in this economy of reputation that we're building online than, for example, any Chilean newspaper. Any newspaper in Latin America, for that matter. This is a really weird world. This is a world where the long tail, where people like Glenn Reynolds, who would have had zero influence in the 20th century, now have disproportionate influence. He now has more influence than huge media conglomerates with thousands of employees. In this world, the amateurs have as much power as the professionals. There are, at the latest count, about 10 million blogs. Those 10 million blogs, which include the few that I've showed you at the top of the curve, and most of them at the bottom of the curve, collectively have more power than the entire media industry. Now, their power is not felt in the same way. It's not mass power. What it is niche power. Each one of them has their own niche. Each one of them is focused with laser precision on something that is unique to them. Maybe it's them and their friends. Maybe it's their community. Maybe it's their hobbies. Maybe it is their particular opinion. It doesn't matter. There's a lot of minority taste out there. There's a lot of room at the bottom. And the nightmare for me in the mass media business is that I have to compete with an army of ants. I who am forced by my model to make one-size-fits-all products for millions of consumers, am forced to compete with millions of consumers who are making one-size-fits-a-few products. I don't have room for minority taste. I don't have room for most of the interests in this room. The only place that has room for most of the interests in this room is a marketplace of infinite shelf space, and that is the internet. We are creating a world where the giants of the 20th century are not just forced to compete, but we are at a disadvantage. We are actually unable to scale down to the micro. We are unable to scale down to where most people live, because our model doesn't have room for the small. It only has room for the big. I wanted to end by showing you a video that a friend of mine made a few years ago that sort of speaks to this, and then we're going to turn to questions and answers. So let's hope the video works, and I'll take your questions afterwards.
No one would have believed in the closing years of the 20th century that our most popular media were being watched in a new way by a force that was quietly gathering strength. With blind confidence, we considered them our own, our audience, our subscribers, our cuddly couch potatoes. With infinite complacency, we blithely segmented and sold them to advertisers. We learned to shape their habits, mold their desires, and give them the illusion of infinite choice. Yet from their side of the screen, with envious eyes, they studied us. And bit by bit, they learned and linked and drew their plans against us. Wielding weapons we ourselves provided. And then, early in the 21st century, came the great unraveling. We offered free choice, but all they heard was free. We devised more powerful, more complete, more feature-rich software, but they preferred to brew their own. They pounced, and they blogged, and they blew the house down. The world we knew was forever disintermediated, whatever that means. They have tasted power, and there are a lot more of them than there are of us. High inside our glass towers, our greatest minds prepare to respond.
Well, can't we just start blogging back at them?
Well, yeah, but... where's the money in that?